Welcome to Business Watch, second last show of the year, and all eyes on the central banks this week. They are the theme of the week, with the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank and the US Federal Reserve all meeting in the coming days. The Fed set to be the most highly anticipated, with analysts expecting central bankers stateside to increase the tapering of its bond buying program to $30 billion per month from the current $15 billion per month in the face of sustained and growing consumer inflation. Rising interest rates and inflation are in the news, and for many, this can impact your financial quality of life because affording the usual comforts becomes increasingly more expensive. Here in South Africa, we've been relatively insulated, but certainly all around the world, inflation is running hotter than it has in many decades. But what does this mean for your investment strategy and for portfolio construction into the new year? Well, Peter Little, fund manager at Anchor Capital, Sumesh Chetty, portfolio manager at 91, and Old Mutual Wealth Investment Strategist Jason Schwartz are thinking long and hard about this at the moment. Gents, thanks for joining us. Let's start with the basics. What impact does rising inflation, or rather, shall we say, rising interest rates have on financial markets? Peter, you can kick us off.
Thanks, Michael. So I would say a couple of things to start off with. Very different scenario, as you say, here in South Africa, offshore. So offshore, the US is kind of the poster child for what might go wrong with inflation. And that's largely a function of a demand pull, so a huge amount of stimulus into that economy. And so purchase of goods, for example, is about 10-12% ahead of where its pre-pandemic trajectory was. And so that's creating issues at the same time as the struggling with supply chain issues. So you've got demand and supply issues moving in opposite directions. And also you have increasing wage pressure starting to get through. So the participation rate in their working age population dropped from about 63% pre-pandemic to just over 61% now. So they're struggling to drag people back into the labor market for various reasons, and that's causing wage inflation. And so those are the kind of inflationary pressures that we're dealing with for the first time in a few decades in the U.S. South Africa, we don't have any of those issues. So we didn't stimulate to the extent that consumers had all this free cash that they were looking to go out and spend. We have a huge amount of slack in our labor market. So it's not like we're struggling to drag people into the labor market. So very different scenario here as to offshore. And I think we're certainly in the camp that we think that these inflationary pressures offshore are dragging on longer than we would have liked, but we still see them subsiding in the second half of next year.
A lot of that because of not just base effects, but the issues that we're seeing around supply chains hopefully being sorted out as the pandemic becomes a little bit more endemic. And so potentially not structural issues, but temporary one-offs. It is interesting to see whether or not this will become baked in. Sumesh, let's maybe just have a look at a kind of theoretical model here around the way inflation and interest rates tend to interact in financial markets.
And so thanks, Michael. I mean, basically the way you need to think about it, the most simplistic way is high inflation ultimately leads to higher interest rates because central banks around the world want to control the inflation in the economy because inflation ultimately erodes savings. And higher interest rates ultimately mean that the future value of profits goes down. So in other words, simply, interest rates go up, stock prices usually come down, and you see the same with bond prices. So what central banks across the world are going to try now is that they're going to straddle this uneasy space of preserving consumer wealth so that consumption continues, but while still attempting to constrain inflation so that you don't erode the value of a rand or the value of a dollar. And ultimately, what one needs to do as an investor in the current market is find investments that can weather either an inflationary uplift or this rising interest rate environment.
And I think that's a great way of looking at it and why we tend to see equity markets going down in a rising interest rate environment, although it's not the same for all areas of the market, and we'll come to that. Jason, how do you view this interaction between interest rates and inflation in financial markets currently?
I think it's right to look at that relationship in that interest rates tend to follow inflation because central banks are trying to create price stability. I think the one thing that you need to also look at is what is growth doing at the same time as inflation, because you could think about a high inflation environment, which is poor for equities, and you want to kind of be more defensive position. But if you have an environment where you have high inflation, but also high growth, that you still get earnings growth, you get it passed through. Even though it's late cycle, you still can afford to be aggressively positioned in portfolios. So you can be pro-cyclical, you can have more equities than cash. So I think it's quite important to think about what inflation and interest rates are doing. But if you're in the early stage of a tightening cycle, is what should be seen, you can still have time to be patient around having more growth assets and more risk assets and positioning in a more aggressive way. Mm-hmm. And when we transition to growth becoming more trend-like, and that's where you probably need to be more defensive, have a bit more protection and hedge that transition into a stagflationary environment.
And that's why when we're in the middle of this year thinking about stagflation potentially, that was the big concern for markets, and very, very concerned around 1970s style stagflation and the impact that had on equities at that time. Pete, why do different areas of the market react differently to interest rate changes? From a kind of theoretical perspective here, you may have an environment where, yes, interest rates are rising, but that's pretty good for banks and not good for tech stocks, for example, that have been really on the speculative end of a lot of this easy money at the moment.
Yeah, so as the guys were saying, the concept of higher rates and discounting cash flows that you're going to receive in the future back at those higher rates basically reduces their present value, and tech stocks are, you know, the ultimate in terms of how much of their growth we're expecting or how much of their income we're expecting to see way down the line, and so they're most sensitive in theory at least to these higher interest rates relative to a company that's kind of mature and delivering a lot of its income to you in the near term. I mean, I guess it's sort of offset slightly because the tech stocks are the ones which aren't operating in saturated markets where there's generally less, there's much more pricing power. So they're not kind of competing with a saturated market and having to worry that if they push prices, they're going to lose market share to their peers. So they have much more pricing power to be able to defend their margins against inflation. So it's a kind of it's a bit of an offsetting kind of environment where it's, like theoretically, they're more sensitive to higher rates, but if those higher rates have been caused by high inflation, they're also more able to defend against that from a margin perspective.
I suppose we have to be, we have to be nuanced around which tech stocks we're talking about, because I do think there are tech stocks, and if you think of Nikola and others that were on the far more speculative end of the curve versus the FANGs and the established incumbents who have that pricing power. Sumesh, how do the different sectors in the market respond to interest rate changes? Just take us through, the traditional response that we should be seeing now if we're entering a rising interest rate environment.
Yeah, so, as you point out, or as you said, the different sectors perform very differently, right? So if you think about South Africa, we're all well aware of the interest rate sensitives that make up a large component of our market. You've got the banks, you've got the property companies, you've got the retailers. And of course, in a rising interest rate environment, even those stocks, I mean, there's nuance to it, even those stocks themselves can behave somewhat differently. You look at a bank, rising interest rates, of course, mean that the consumer is under more pressure, you can get more defaults. But rising interest rates also mean that banks charge you more, but they don't pay you as much interest. So you get what we call the endowment effect, that bank profitability goes up on one side, but you have this potential hit in terms of defaults in the bank. On the discretionary retailer side, of course, higher interest rates mean that it's harder for the consumer to borrow, to buy things that they don't necessarily need, they don't have to have. We're not talking about food, for example, we're talking about clothing. And of course, on the property company side, these are businesses that have a lot of debt, so of course they're going to feel pain. And the present value of their future rental streams obviously goes down. Now, you have capital-intensive businesses, another industry South Africans are very familiar with, mining, resource companies. And they have to deal with ultimately a higher cost of funding to ensure that new capital projects that they engage in, a new mine shop, for example, are appropriate. You know, the corollary of that is that if interest rates are going up because of inflation, it's quite likely that the commodity basket, you know, the underlying resource price, is actually benefiting from higher inflation. And of course, as Pete just said, you get long duration tech that potentially gets hurt. But as you said, there are differences. You get businesses like Microsoft, for example, highly cash generative. Rising interest rates mean that it will probably do quite well. And then you've got those businesses, the hope trade, effectively, hopefully they will make cash at some point in the future. They're not going to do very well at all. And then finally, you have the consumer staples that should be relatively unaffected. You know, the food retailers of the world, the food producers of the world. And those businesses may actually benefit if there's cash on balance sheet.
It's so much to unpack in that when we come to how you position yourself in an environment like this, because it is all about getting the macro tea leaves correct in understanding whether or not we're going to still have growth in a rising interest rate environment, or potentially the rising interest rates start to choke off growth and by extension then start to choke off equity returns as well, and those fundamentals that we're talking about at the same time. Jason, if we look at it, previous interest rate decreases were obviously in response to economic and market shocks. And the pandemic has been exactly the same as previous periods of the global financial crisis, if one thinks of the most recent one. Yet they didn't have an impact immediately, or as effectively, one might argue, as they did in previous cycles. So the current phase appears to be somewhat at odds with previous cycles. Why is this?
I think the pandemic was an unprecedented event in the sense that you had this virus that was spreading, there was decreased mobility, central banks had to cut rates and create that liquidity and accommodation, and for a lot of industries, you know, there was no real way for them to grow earnings, for them to be able to perform. So I think the monetary mechanism and monetary policy, you know, for a long time has tried to be accommodative, and this kind of just created this big dislocation. So what you see now is you're slowly seeing inflation coming back. You're seeing goods demand and demand side create inflation. And that's why I think the Fed, and particularly a lot of central banks, are being extra patient around creating inflation and creating demand to come back in the system. And I think that's probably what you're going to see this week, is for them to reiterate that patience around inflation. There has been some hawkishness around what the rhetoric has been, but I think for a long time you'll have the secular period of lower for longer interest rates, to be able to stimulate economies, to be able to get industries back up and running.
Especially at a time when we see global debt levels. Sumesh, would you like to respond to that? Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to add something. You've got to be very careful about this assumption that it's actually lower interest rates that have resulted in the recovery. So central banks obviously are using this tool in their arsenal or in their inventory. But ultimately, what you've got to think about is that the recovery happened far quicker than we expected, because the vaccine was discovered far quicker than we expected. You know, typically a vaccine would take 5, 10, 15 years. The fact that one was discovered within 6 months and rolled out within 12 months, you know, clearly a reopening of the economy that was far stronger than the impact of interest rates. And those interest rate cuts, that quantitative easing, the fiscal stimulus in general, what that's done is it's supercharged the market, and of course it's led to this inflation. But I wouldn't link the extreme interest rate cuts that we saw in 2020 to the recovery that we're seeing right now.
I mean, the vaccine rollout has far exceeded in most developed markets even the most optimistic forecasts. We're still yet to see that here in South Africa, but that's an entirely different story for another day, around hesitancy for whatever reason, and we're still below 50%, no longer a supply-side issue. We've got more than enough vaccine. Pete, I was watching Mohammed Al-Erian on Bloomberg the other day, and he said the use of the word transitory by Jay Powell might go down in history potentially as one of the Fed's greatest mistakes. Where do you sit on that whole spectrum debate between transitory versus more general and sustained rises in prices? Because 1982 was the last time we saw 6.8% interest rates in the US. inflation, I should say, interest rates back then were at 21.5%, I think. If you look at where they are now, it's fair to say the Fed looks a little bit behind the curve here.
Yeah, that's right. And certainly even they've started toning their language down to say that it's sort of they're removing transitory from the statement and not talking about it as much. We're still in the camp that believes that in the second half of next year, inflation in the US will start trending back towards 2. So I think we still see it above 4 for the first half of 2022. And then it'll gradually head back towards a sort of 2-2.5% range, which is much more palatable for the Fed. I think that the toughest thing with inflation, and it's one of the hardest things to forecast, is that it's at least partially a psychological impact. So if you think, I mean, as South Africans, we're kind of well aware of this. You have a 6% inflation number in your mind, and so when it comes to, you know, salary negotiations, that's kind of your starting level. When it comes to signing a lease, the landlord wants to increment your rent by at least 6% every year, and that's kind of becomes then self-fulfilling. Everybody's preempting these higher inflation and basically sustaining it for this. And I think in the US we've managed to, and developed markets in general, we've managed to squeeze this out. We've had good central bank policy. We've had demographic changes that have helped that. And I think what you don't want to do is get back into this kind of psychological cycle where people are preempting higher inflation and starting to kind of push salaries and rentals and prices of goods above that in anticipation. And so I think the Fed's doing a good job of kind of talking it down, making sure people realize that this is kind of a lot of this stuff is transitory. And certainly we're in the camp that thinks that as prices start subsiding, as supply chain issues start subsiding, as the base effect kicks in the second half of next year, this will reinforce the sort of mantra that it is largely transitory.
Sumesh, where are you? Is it transitory or more general?
I think it's more general. You have to be very careful because the world has changed. So, you know, just-in-time manufacturing, which was effectively implemented by the Japanese and copied by manufacturers and businesses across the world, that's over now, because I think a lot more fat has to be put into the system. So the supply chain disruptions that we've seen over the last 2 years, there are a lot of businesses that aren't going to want to experience that again. And so if you're bringing your manufacturing back onshore, especially in developed markets, that obviously is going to be subject to higher wage pressures, for example. So deglobalization ultimately is going to be driving some of that inflation. And the other thing we need to think about as a society is not only do you have deglobalization, but you've also got decarbonization and the energy supply disruptions that are going to go along with that. One of my colleagues has this fantastic line. I mean, everyone is aware that China has been exporting deflation, but his line is China has been exporting deflation to the rest of the world, but it's been importing emissions. And if you look at what's happening in the world today, China wants to decrease the emissions in their country, so will most likely not want to be exporting deflation to the rest of the world. So we have to be very careful about how this inflation scenario plays out. I'm hesitant to believe it's transitory. I do think over the very, very long term, you know, the numbers that Pete's talking about are completely acceptable. But over the medium term, the next 2 to 5 years, I think we need to be somewhat careful about how we think about this, and also think about it in terms of Omicron, because even if Omicron is nothing more than a cold, and no disrespect to people who've suffered more than that, you are still going to have additional disruptions emerging from this. When you think about people who won't send their kids to school or schools that shut down preemptively, you are potentially going to have people staying at home to provide that childcare and create further disruptions in the workforce. Now, that's not something that the global economy can deal with very easily in conjunction with everything else that's going on. So we are somewhat concerned.
That's why I love markets. That's why I love markets, because it's the big debating point at the moment, and it does divide a lot of people. There's a very cogent argument to be made for both transitory and more generalized rises in inflation. And Jason, I'd like your thoughts on this as well, because on the other side, we still have a lot of those forces that were keeping a lid on inflation in place, such as efficiency gains, technology, all of that. And that certainly has been heightened through the pandemic. We've managed to switch to a new world of work, a model of work quite quickly. Where do you sit on the spectrum between transitory and more generalized inflation?
So I don't actually see the other two panelists as disagreeing much, because it's very difficult for short-term inflation to stay at 5-6% globally just because of those base effects. Even if oil stays at $100 for the next couple of years, you need that incremental rise in prices, and you're going to get fading, you're going to get congestion in shipping, you're going to get fading of rates, you're going to get labor market. So short-term inflation almost has to be transitory, because, and that, I think the Fed is seeing through that, and that's fine. I don't disagree with Sumesh in that medium term, a lot of inflation impacts are going to start being higher than pre-pandemic levels. So a lot of output gaps have closed, and all that excess capacity, all the marginal demand is going to be inflationary. So we'll likely see inflation over the medium term, not around 2%, probably 3-4%. And that's, I think that's not a controversial view. I think that's something that you have to think about for portfolios. Mm.
And also, I mean, if we think about what central banks have been doing, guys, injecting all of this liquidity into the market post the global financial crisis, the last thing the Fed wanted was a Japanese style period of stagflation. No inflation. So it would have been surprising to not see, and indeed disappointing to not see, some inflation. So it's about managing, you know, just the rate of growth of that inflation into the future as well, that I think the Fed is going to be challenged to try and do. How do you position yourself then? Just let's go around the table. We've got 4 minutes to go. Pete, how are you positioning for this period in the cycle?
So I think a lot of this is already in the prices, and it's kind of looking at areas that have sort of incremental growth from here. I think a couple of areas offshore, for example, we think the med tech companies, where people have stayed away from hospitals for knee and hip replacements and the like, and they've under-earned essentially through this pandemic period, as we see the economies and the medical sector better able to deal with that. I think we see them restoring profitability, and it's quite nice defensive profitability as well. So that's one area offshore we certainly think is pretty interesting. And then I think just operators who are able to kind of, I think the larger companies where you have stronger balance sheets that kind of, and can manage their way through some of these little additional wobbles and waves that we're going to see through, and not necessarily be forced to kind of push prices to defend margins, I think those ones will be in better shape. So those are the kind of companies we're looking for going forward.
Sumesh, how are you positioning?
So we don't tactically allocate based on the economic view. We're taking a longer term view. And, you know, to Jason's point, one of the things we're focusing on is where can you achieve growth? And it's especially important for a South African investor, because there's no growth to be had. You can't look at 2021 and 2022. You've got to look at, you know, ultimately, how do we achieve growth above 0%? You know, and that's where we were in 2019, longer term. So if you're looking for growth, and that's really important if you're looking to outperform inflation, the best opportunity for growth is actually offshore. So we're looking at high quality offshore equities. We've got a combination of tech and consumer staples in the tech space. We're not investing in the fangs. We're investing in businesses that are a step or two steps removed from that, highly cash generative. I mentioned Microsoft. We like businesses like VeriSign, for example. And then we still like the likes of a Nestle. We still like the likes of Philip Morris. The other great opportunity, especially for South African investors in terms of the domestic investment, South African government bonds. And I know it sounds like a swear word given how people think about our government, but if you buy our 10-year bond right now, you're getting a 5% real yield. If you buy inflation-linked bonds, and they're really the only true protection against inflation, you're getting a 4% real yield. And then there are a couple of names in South Africa that we like, but we are very, very worried about ultimately consumer discretionary in South Africa at this point. So it's really this balance. Look for growth offshore and look for a bit of ballast or a bit of income and a bit of inflation protection from local bonds.
Yeah, those RSA retail savings bonds make a great core to any portfolio. Jason, how are you positioning yourself at the moment?
So also, as I said, we still think, even though there will be inflation, we'll still have above trend growth. So we still want to be positioned cyclically, have some exposure to risk and equities. And we like specifically equities that can take advantage of inflation, or that where there's inflation beneficiaries, so oil, Harmony Gold, BTI, some of those consumer names where there is pricing power and you've got sticky gross profit margins. And banks also, because, you know, they typically benefit, I think Peter's mentioned, they benefit from the early interest rate rises. They get better spreads and you know, quite well capitalized. So fairly still a risk position, pro-risk position, and then starting to just put on protection given we transition into a more high-risk, low-growth environment in 2023.
Well, there you have it. All eyes will be on the Fed tomorrow as the big central bank meeting is going to be keeping investors transfixed on whether or not we see any further hawkish sentiment coming out of the world's chief central bank, the Fed. Around the table, we had Peter Little, fund manager at Anchor, Sumesh Chetty, portfolio manager at 91, and Old Mutual Wealth investment strategist Jason Swartz, talking about rising inflation and interest rates here on Business Watch. We'll be right back.